White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to the 67th episode of our readings from Henry Ford's four-volume masterpiece. Today's date is October 3rd, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager,
and I'm Hadding Scott.
And we are actually beginning volume four tonight, which means we are three-quarters of the way through this huge tome. The topics in this last volume are about Jews in the American liquor business, treason and traitors among Jews, some of the un-American practices carried on by Jews, and countering their critics and the campaign carried out against these articles and the Dearborn Independent. We begin tonight with a look at the liquor business. It's very eye-opening, I think, and basically tells us the same story that we have been getting, that Jews are harmful to Gentile society in every area one can think of. I mean, this is what we come to. They're not making it up. I mean, every area they look into, they find Jewish conglomerations of Jews acting in concert to do harm to the rest of our society. And to me, they're like sharks in the ocean that have come into the shallow swimming area of humans and are exceedingly dangerous. Everywhere these researchers and investigators of the International Jew series have looked, it's a horror story. What would you say, Hanning?
Well, it doesn't really, from what they say in this chapter, it doesn't really seem to me to be justified to say that the Jews in the liquor trade are going out of their way to do harm. What they're doing is finding ways to make a whole lot of money without much regard for how it affects their customers. That's what they're doing.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't think they even say that they're going out of their way. I said, you know, I'm kind of implying that, I guess, but I don't think they say they're going out, but they're just showing how they do it without any concern. In fact, I think that's one of the things they say, that there's no concern for the people that are being harmed by what they do.
Yeah.
And that's why I call them sharks, because sharks are just doing what they do, and they just don't give a damn, you know. They're not thinking about what harm they're doing, and neither do Jews.
Yeah, it's the Jew as unscrupulous entrepreneur is what it is.
Okay, well, let's find out for the listeners.
All right, you want me to do the preface?
Sure, I think so.
Okay, this is the fourth volume of repeated studies in the Jewish question as they appeared in the Dearborn Independent. The articles follow the same general line as the previous volume in showing the various angles of Jewish influence and achievement in the affairs of the people of the United States. But they do not by any means exhaust either the number of the angles or the depth of the significance in the angles traced. Deliberate public opinion has shown many signs of a new alertness to the movement which was proceeding deftly and unnoticed in the midst of America, and many checks have been put in operation. The work of the Dearborn Independent was undertaken at a disadvantage because of the tremendous emphasis of the American mind on racial peace, and because of the ease with which racial propagandists can make a purely economic and political matter assume the aspects of a religious controversy. The Dearborn Independent opened the question to public gaze and was therefore assumed to be the attacker. In this country, our sense of fairness always leaves the advantage with the attacked, and false accusations quickly fall. The country has seen, however, the truth of the statements. and has observed the mild and unprejudiced manner in which they were made. It may now be said that truth has made its way. Most gratifying are the signs with which Jews themselves have given, that certain abuses must be quickly. A Jewish leader has appealed for the removal of the exemption, which nullifies the Constitution of the United States in favor of the Jew with reference to the use of liquor. Other Jewish leaders have sought to compel Jewish theatrical controllers to observe elementary decency in their productions. These articles have always held that the cleansing must come from within Judah itself. It is recognized that racial pride might prevent many improvements being attempted under fire. But American Jews cannot afford to be ruled by a false pride in this respect.
Yeah.
These are days of judgment for all the corruptive forces of society, and the Jews cannot expect to escape responsibility for their part in these things. May 1922.
Okay. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. I have to skip past several pages now to get to the chapter.
Okay.
Okay. Did you just want to continue now?
Yes. United then by the...
Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah, it's a quote from Bernard Lazar, who is a kind of apologist for the Jews. United then by the strongest feelings of solidarity, the Jews can easily hold their own in this disjointed and anarchic society of ours. If the millions of Christians by whom they are surrounded were to substitute the same principle of cooperation for that of individual competition, the importance of the Jew would immediately be destroyed. The Christian, however, will not adopt the course, and the Jew must inevitably, I will not say dominate, the favorite expression of the anti-Semites, but certainly possess the advantage over the others and exercise the supremacy against which the anti-Semites inveigh without being able to destroy it.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting statement there.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't able to follow while you were reading it just now, but when I read it earlier, I thought it was very, very interesting.
It says, it's what he's saying there is that because Jews stick together and the non-Jews do not stick together.
Right. Yeah. They are ahead. And that's one of the things I was going to, you know, bring out, too. But it's somewhere else, not on this show. But, yeah, I mean, this is the whole thing, because we don't and we can't. And I think it's shameful that we are unable to ever get together on anything. But
and you'll also notice that Jews encourage this ethic among, especially white people in this country.
Yes, yes.
This notion that everybody has to fend for himself. You don't look out for each other. That's
and
what Ayn Rand was all about.
And you should have you should think for yourself. Well, they use that think for yourself so that you don't ever join together and all think alike. That's supposed to be. You know, then you're a robot, you're dominated. But they do it. I mean, there's a lot to be said about all this. And it's becoming clearer to me, than it used to be. I'll say that.
Yeah. And what happened in Germany in the 1930s was the Germans stopped being pure individualists.
Right.
They became a community and acted as a community. And the Jews at that point no longer really had a place there.
Right, and then that's why that's attacked so badly. That's why they portray National Socialist Germany as being something where people had no say, they couldn't open their mouth, and everybody had to salute and believe things they didn't, it's just ridiculous. So, but very effective, very effective. So let's find out what they say here about
that. All right, Chapter 62. How Jews Gained American Liquor Control. To those who have been surprised and confounded by the widespread evidence, which even the newspapers have been unable to suppress, that the bulk of the organized bootlegging which is being carried on in this country is in the hands of Jews, it would have been less of a surprise had they known the liquor history of this country. And of course, when he's referring to liquor bootlegging, this is during Prohibition. And
yeah, and what are the years of Prohibition? Oh, we're in Prohibition now, right? In 1921, they're in Prohibition. I didn't even check that out.
Yeah. Okay. So selling liquor in general was not legal.
Right.
Nor was making it legal.
Right.
The claim made for the Jews that they are a sober people is undoubtedly true. But that has not prevented two facts concerning them, namely that they usually constitute the liquor dealers of the countries where they live in numbers, and that in the United States they are the only people exempted from the operations of the Prohibition Law. Here, as elsewhere, the principle holds true that the Jew is the key. The demoralization which struck the liquor business, causing its downfall, and the demoralization which has struck prohibition enforcement for a time, cannot be understood without a study of the racial elements which contributed to both phenomena. If in what follows the Jews find objectionable elements, they should remember that their own people put them there. It is impossible to doubt that if the organized Jews of the United States were to make 1,000th of the protest against the illegal liquor activities of their own people that they make against the perfectly legal and morally justifiable exposures being made in the Dearborn Independent, the result would be not only favorable, but immediate. There was a time when the term whiskey had a much more respectable connotation than it has today. There was a time when to use whiskey, and even to make it, were customs sanctioned by the better class of public opinion. It is a common explanation of the difference between then and now that the people of the latter period became more sensitive morally than their forebears, that whereas the previous generation guzzled its whiskey, innocently oblivious of the evil in it, the latter generation developed a stronger moral discrimination and banned the custom. The truth is this. The people did not become better. The whiskey became worse. Mm-hmm. When the entire story of the people's justifiable indignation is written, the competent historian will trace along with the people's rising disgust the whiskey's decreasing quality. Attention to this matter will materially assist an understanding of the fact that Jews and bootlegging are so continuously and prominently connected in the public prints these days. Readers of the old romances know how proud the master was of his wines. Vintages ripened under certain skies, on certain hills, where certain waters flowed, with cellarage in certain soils, had a faculty of aging gracefully, mellowing to a smoothness and purity and desirableness that made for cheer and health, without the alloy of sordid inebriety. The bouquet of wine, the perfected essence of the grape, subjected to the further courses of nature, has been a theme of praise for centuries. Were uttered today, the source of the utterance would be suspected, and very probably with good reason, of being in pay of the wets.
Yeah, now the wets were the people who were against prohibition, and the dries were those who were for it, right?
And even today you have so-called wet counties and dry counties.
Okay, right. All right.
For the vile stuff which civilization threw out is not at all the wine of popular custom and century-long esteem. Nevertheless, it is not difficult for even a modern to grasp the fact that there was an art in making wine and strong drink, in which art men took pride. That art required time, experience, a love of good quality. It is a little difficult to speak of this art in connection with whiskey, wine being a more poetic word. Yet it is a matter of knowledge that three places in the world have devoted to the production of whiskey the same spirit which France and Portugal devoted to their wines. These three districts are Glenlivet in Scotland, the region of Dublin in Ireland, and the Bluegrass region of Kentucky. Why in these three regions? First, because there were men, non-Jews, of course, who were willing to wait 10 years to produce a good article. Second, the waters of these regions are of a quality which is beautifully adapted to the making of pure goods. Pure whiskey, it should be remembered, is a vegetable product matured by natural forces and no other. Grain, water, and time. Not even artificial heat added, nor any other thing, completes the best whiskey product. In older times in America, there were men who were as choice of their whiskies as of their horse or books. There was then such a thing as quality. But there was no such thing as delirium tremens. That came later, with the disappearance of pure whiskey. A distiller seldom grew rich. He was too engrossed in maintaining the quality of his product, and it consumed much time. There were certain brands known nationally because of their mildness and purity, purest wine of the choicest grapes, aged in the best adapted cellars, was not more mild or pure than these whiskies. There are names that remain until this day, Pepper, Crow, Taylor, and the others, the names of men who took time and pains, whose names became brands, which guaranteed quality and purity. These men were distillers in the true sense, not manufacturers nor compounders, but distillers in a time when distilling was both a science and an art. And they aimed to conceal a gigantic fraud on the public. In time to come, when the people's justifiable moral indignation will permit a study of the steps by which the reputation of whiskey came to its present low degree, they will see how much better it would have been, how much more efficacious and clarifying, if the attack on whiskey had included an exposure of the men who had driven whiskey out of the country and were selling rank poison as a substitute. The saloon, the brewer, the man who used strong drink, were all of them made the target for attack. The Jews, who demoralized the whole business, went on collecting their enormous and illegitimate profits without so much as their identity being revealed. Whiskey ceased to be whiskey, and beer grew less like beer. The results upon humanity became apparent and deplorable. So society raised the license fee and increased the restrictions. To meet this, the Jewish compounders turned out still cheaper stuff, and still more vicious mixtures. Licenses went up and quality went down, the Jewish compounders always getting a larger margin of profit. And through the long, long fight, no one, with one or two notable exceptions, had the sense and the courage to point a finger at the solid racial phalanx lined up behind, whole rotten combination. Distilling is one of the long list of businesses which has been ruined by Jewish monopoly. Those who favor prohibition will probably thank the Jew for his work in that direction. It may be that the Jew is destiny's agent to demoralize the business that must pass away. But set against the fact that it is Jewish influence that demoralizes prohibition, too. And both wets and dries have an interesting situation to consider. In general, the Jews are on the side of liquor and always have been. They are the steadiest drinkers of all. That is why they were able to secure exemption from the prohibition laws. Their religious ceremonies require them to drink an amount which the law has considered to equal 10 gallons a year. And so, the prohibition law of the United States, a part of the Constitution of the United States, is made legally ineffective to the extent of 10 gallons a year a Jew. The amount, of course, is very much more. It is always easy to get 100 gallons through a 10-gallon loophole. In fact, thousands of gallons have come through that 10-gallon loophole.
You know, this is really interesting to me. I had no idea that, you know, Jews were actually exempt from the prohibition laws up to a certain extent, because there again, their religious ceremonies require them to drink. What the heck are they drinking? I didn't know that they had to drink all this stuff in their religious ceremonies. Do you know anything about it?
Well, I don't, you know, they use wine when they do circumcision.
Only a little few sips or something.
The moil takes wine into his mouth. It's used as an antiseptic, I guess.
Isn't that something? That they could, you know, insist on all that. Communion, they had wine, but what are they supposed to, they can substitute something else. Well, they don't use wine anymore, do they? Anywhere.
Oh, but, probably. I have an old photograph of a Jew carrying during Prohibition what looks like probably 2 5-gallon jars of wine, jugs of wine. During Prohibition, yeah. You think he's going to use all that for religious services? Maybe he's going to retail some of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just more of their stuff that they get away with. Because they pull out their religion. All right.
It will come to many people as new knowledge that the liquor business of the world has been in the hands of Jews. In the United States, the liquor business was almost exclusively in the hands of Jews for 25 years previous to Prohibition. During the period, in fact, when the liquor trade was giving point and confirmation to prohibition arguments. This knowledge has an important bearing on the interpretation of our times. In the volume, The Conquering Jew, published by Funk and Wagnalls Company in 1916, John Foster Fraser writes, "The Jews are masters of the whiskey trade in the United States. 80% of the members of the National Liquor Dealers Association are Jews. It has been shown that 60% of the business in distilling and wholesale trade in whiskey is in the hands of Jews. As middlemen, they control the wine product of California. Jews visit the tobacco-growing states and buy up nearly all the leaf tobacco, so that the great tobacco companies have to buy the raw product from them. The Jews have a grip on the cigar trade. The American Tobacco Company manufactures about 15% of the cigars smoked in the United States. The Jews provide the rest. It was also true in Russia, Poland, Romania. The Jewish Encyclopedia states that the establishment of the government liquor monopoly in Russia in 1896 deprived thousands of Jewish families of a livelihood. They controlled the liquor traffic, the vodka business, which undermined Russia. The government made the liquor business a national monopoly in order to abolish it, which was done. Liquor in Russia was Jewish, as the encyclopedia testifies. Anyone reading carefully the article on Russia, especially pages 527 and 559 in the Jewish Encyclopedia, will be in no doubt as to the fact. In Romania, the whole Jewish question was the liquor question. The land of the peasants came into control of the liquor sellers, and the business of handling liquors was a strict Jewish monopoly for years. In Poland, the same was true. It is not surprising, therefore, that in the United States, whiskey also became Jewish. For convenience in detailing this story, most of the observations made will center in the state of Kentucky. Almost everyone of age knows the phrase, "fine old Kentucky whiskeys." It was once a phrase that meant something. Kentucky produced in her limestone regions the kind of water that served best with the grain ingredients of whiskey. The word bourbon, known mostly as a kind of whiskey, is really the name of a county in Kentucky where bourbon whiskey was first made. How profoundly the region in which whiskey is manufactured affects the product may be gathered from the fact that a primitive Kentucky distiller named Shields, who became famous for a brand of bourbon made from the waters of Glen's Creek, conceived the idea of lowering his costs by transferring his distillery to Illinois, where he would be nearer the rich cornfields. He was disappointed. Illinois water would not make bourbon. The rule of the region is supreme. Jamaica rum owes its characteristic to the waters of Jamaica. Port wine is best produced in the region of Douro in Portugal. Champagne in the region of Rheims in France, and beer in Bavaria. And so, in Kentucky, there was the right combination of elements which made the whiskey product of that state world famous. Alcoholic spirit from grain may be made in any climate and by many methods. Neutral spirits, high wines, and alcohol are not indigenous anywhere. They can be made in any back room or cellar in very little time. Little care is required. A concoction of drugs and spirits, properly colored and flavored, fraudulently labeled whiskey and passed out over the bar, is a crime against the art of distilling, against the human nervous system, and against society. Readers may recall that in 1904, Dr. Wiley, then chief of the United States Bureau of Chemistry, had a great deal to say about this. But because he did not point out that the evil he was attacking was fostered by a single class of men, bent on gain at the cost of ruin to an American industry and to countless thousands of American citizens, few paid any attention to him. The public supposed that Dr. Wiley was discussing a technical question which interested American distillers only. It vastly more interested the American citizen, if he had but known it, if anyone had but had the clear vision and the courage to expose the great Jewish whiskey conspiracy.
Uh-huh, now they're calling it the great Jewish whiskey conspiracy.
Well, it's a conspiracy insofar as, well, certain factors that he's going to explain about how the way they have sold a kind of fake whiskey has been covered up. Somehow they've gotten the government to allow that, and prohibition apparently turned out to be, in effect, a kind of protection for Jewish-made moonshine, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it started all this cheap, lousy alcohol that people were drinking, anything, you know, to get a buzz, I guess. And then it just allowed that to continue. People's palates were destroyed, I guess, or their sense of what's better and what's not as good.
Well, if you introduce the bad stuff gradually, then people aren't aware of it.
Yep.
The difference between the non-Jewish and the Jewish method, as illustrated in the history of American whiskey, is thus described by Dr. Wiley. The aging of whiskey takes years of time. It is expensive. The whiskey leaks out. It is allowed to stand for 4 years at least. The object of this is to permit the oxidation of the alcohols. There is a loss of interest on the value of the whiskey while it is aging, hence it is an expensive process. But the manufacture of compounded or artificial whiskey has for its purpose the avoiding of this long and expensive process. The makers begin with the pure article of spirits, which can be made in a few hours. To this is added enough water to dilute it to the strength of whiskey. The next step is to color it. This is done by adding burnt sugar and caramel. The next thing is to supply the flavors. By the way, I have described, in 2 or 3 hours, the compounder can make a material which looks like, smells like, tastes like, and analyzes like genuine whiskey, but it has a different effect on the system. The people who drink this whiskey are much more liable to receive injury from it than those who drink the genuine article. All sorts of practices were resorted to. Drugs and raw crops of whiskey were bought up, and the business of rectifying, as it was called, began the ruin of the natural and wholesome process of distilling. Quick money, regardless of what happened to the customer, that was the motive of the rectifying business.
I was just going to say, this whole thing about rectifying is what they call not making the same quality whiskey that they used to, which was aged for years.
This rectifying business was mostly Jewish. Here and there, a non-Jew was associated with Jewish partners, but rarely. The way had found to trade on the reputation of the term whiskey by compounding a liquid which looked and tasted like whiskey, but the effect of which was harmful. That was the capital fraud, the capture of the name whiskey for a synthetic poison. There was a concealment of the meaning of rectified spirits. a deceptive use of the word blend, and even a most fraudulent misrepresentation concerning aging. If chemical deception could be used to make a whiskey taste as if it were 9 years old, then it was advertised as 9 years in the wood. Here is a bit of Jewish court testimony. Question. Is your make of whiskey 9 years old? 9 years old. But I want to explain in that respect that the whiskey may not have existed 9 years before it was put into that bottle. That brand of whiskey which we brand is 9 years old blended means that it is equal to 9 year old whiskey in smoothness and quality. How did you arrive at the fact which you put upon this bottle that the whiskey was 9 years old? Because it is comparatively 9 years old. How do you arrive at that result? By sampling. You take the whiskey that is allowed to remain in the original package for 9 years and compare it with our 9 year old blend, and you will find them in smoothness the same. Therefore, we class it as 9 year old whiskey.
He keeps saying our 9 year old blend, but it isn't. I think they blend a little bit of 9 year old into it sometimes, you know, to make it seem like it should be, and then I have all this other stuff. Oh, God.
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe they call it a blend because they took alcohol and added coloring and flavoring to it. That would be a blend.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, all this language dishonesty, we know how it works in every field, in every area. But this is really funny and interesting.
Let the reader form his own judgment on that type of mind. The whiskey bore a name resembling a time-honored brand of pure goods, and it flaunted the name Kentucky. When it was not whiskey at all, was not a Kentucky product, but was compounded of neutral spirits from Indiana, prune juice from California, rock candy from anywhere, and raw Illinois whiskey from Peoria to give it flavor. Although Louisville, Kentucky became headquarters of whiskey men, it was Cincinnati, Ohio, a thoroughly Judaized city, which became a greater headquarters for the pseudo-whiskey men, the compounders, mixers, and rectifiers. The list of Cincinnati liquor dealers reads like a directory of the Warsaw Ghetto. In Louisville, the Judaic complexion of the city, as well as society, is very noticeable. Indeed, most of the leading Jews in the whiskey business are now Kentucky colonels. By the way, do you know that Harlan Sanders was a Jew?
I was thinking about that when I read that. I thought I remembered that it turned out he was a Jew. Quite yeah. Amazing, because he sure doesn't look like it. Of course, they've got him all portrayed, you know, like an old Southern gentleman.
But, yeah, well, he kind of adopted a caricature as his persona, and people accepted that, I guess. But he died in a Jewish hospital.
Oh. Yeah. Well, they do go back to that at the end.
The Jewish character of the whiskey business since the Civil War may be visualized by the same expedient of noting how many of the better-known brands have been at various dates under Jewish control. Of course, I don't think anybody will have heard of any of these, but we'll go through this.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, but
there
go
is
ahead.
Old 66, owned by Strauss Pritz and Company, Highland Rye, owned by Freilich and Workham, T.W. Samuel, Old Style, Sour Mash, owned by Max Hirsch, the Star Distilling Company, Bridgewater Sour Mash and Rye Whiskies, Rosewood and Westbrook Bourbon Whiskies, distributed, distilled by J&A Freiberg. T. T.J. Monarch and Davies County Sour Mash Whiskies, controlled by J&A Freiberg. Louis Hunter 1870, Crystal Wedding, and Old Jug, blended by J&A Freiberg. Ganymede 76, put out by Sigmund and Saul H. Freiberg. Jigsaw Kentucky Corn Whiskey, Lindale Whiskey, Brunswick Rye and Bourbon, by Hofheimer Brothers Company. They have all these so good names. Red Top Rye and White House Club, by Ferdinand Westheimer and Sons. Green River came into the control of E. La Montague. Sunnybrook, a widely advertised brand on whose advertising matter a man in a United States inspector's uniform stood behind it as if endorsing it, was at the time owned by Rosenfeld Brothers and Company. Mount Vernon, as from the Hannes Distilling Company, was at the time owned by Angelo Meyer. Bell of Nelson came into the control of the Jewish Trust, which was brought to legal birth by Levi Meyer and Alfred Austrian, the latter being the Chicago attorney whose name will be recalled in connection with the baseball articles in this series. James E. Pepper was owned by James Wolfe. Cedar Brook was owned by Julius Kessler and Company. It was formerly the old W.H. McBrayer brand. But the real W.H. McBrayer, knowing the new methods that were arising in liquor making, requested in his will that his name should not be used as a brand after he had ceased to see that the product was worthy of his name. In the Pittsburgh and Peoria districts, the same story held true. The alleged whiskey made in those districts was controlled, with one exception, by Jews. The Great Western Distillery in Peoria is owned by a corporation of Jews. Two of its brands were Ravenswood Rye and Ravenswood Bourbon. The Woolner Distillery made Old Grove Whiskey and Old Ryan Whiskey and Bucha Gin. In the city of Peoria alone, there are 15 great fortunes, all held by Jews, and for the most part made in what passed in Peoria for whiskey.
And this is Peoria, Illinois. I don't think they mentioned.
Take the city of Cincinnati alone, and note what even an incomplete list reveals as to the names of the men classified as distillers. Bernheim Rexinger and Company, Elias Bloch and Sons, J&A Freiberg, Freiberg and Werkum, Helferich and Sons, Hofheimer Brothers and Company, Elias Hyman and Sons, Kaufman, Bear and Company, Kleiners, A. Loeb and Company, H. Rosenthal and Sons, Seligman Distilling Company, Strauss, Fritz and Company, S. N. Weil and Company, and F. Westheimer and Sons, with many other Jews concealed under fancy trade names and corporation designations. It is the same throughout Ohio, which state, incidentally, is one of the most Jew-ridden states in the Union.
I think that's a great line. It's amazing that they wrote that in the way that they did. But it's true about Ohio. I've learned that myself over the last few years, writing things, you know, following Elie Wiesel. And he goes to these schools and things in Ohio. It's whether it's Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus, any of those places, there's just tons of Jews operating and doing all their Holocaust promotion.
Yep.
Amazing. And they say it right here.
The lists here given do not by any means begin to indicate the numbers of the Jews who were engaged in the liquor business. They only indicate the complexion which the business takes on when a search is made behind the brands and the trade names. Any citizen in any city of size will have no trouble in confirming the statement that most of the rectifiers and wholesalers and brokers in the whiskey trade of his city also were Jews. But it is not only the fact that the liquor business was controlled by Jews that assumes importance. That is a fact which no one will deny, not even the Jewish defenders. But it is the additional fact that there was spread over this country the machinery of a vicious system which, while it was destined to ruin the liquor business, as perhaps it deserved to be ruined, also ruined hundreds of thousands of citizens who trusted that pure and unadulterated meant what the words were intended to convey. It would be a separate story to tell of all the manipulation of labels, the piracy of brand names, the conscienceless play upon the words pure and unadulterated, of which the un-American compounded liquor combine was guilty. Let me read that whole sentence again. It would be a separate story to tell of all the manipulation of labels, the piracy of brand names, the conscienceless play upon the words pure and unadulterated, of which the un-American compounded liquor combine was guilty. Of course, the stuff was pure and unadulterated. So is carbolic acid. But it was not whiskey. There were law violations galore. And it was well enough recognized in the rectifying business as a regular practice to appropriate annually a certain sum to pay the fines that were bound to be assessed against it. A riot of adulteration and chicanery ensued, with whiskey being made in many saloon cellars, and the dangerous secrets of synthetic booze-making be peddled abroad among the customers of the trust. Presently, the saloon men became aware of the fact that they were the goats of the game. Seldom was the Jew engaged in dishing out 5-cent beers or 10-cent whiskies. It remained for the boob Gentile to do that. The Jew was at the wholesale end where the real profits were made. But it was the saloon man who took the brunt of the blame. The Jewish distillers, as the compounders and blenders of the Louisville and Peoria districts were called, wore silk hats, and their respectability was unquestioned. The saloon men made an 11th-hour effort to save their business, but the stuff they were pouring out had not improved, and prohibition came, sweeping the saloon away. But as the sequel will show, not depriving the Jewish compounder of his profits. How much of the liquor business of the United States was in whiskey, and how much in rectified spirits? The 12th census of the United States, 1900, said, most of the distilled liquors consumed as a beverage by the American people pass through rectifying houses. The chief classes of rectified spirits range from the cheapest concoctions of neutral spirits and drugs to the simple blending of young and old whiskey. 20 years ago, statistics showed that 80% of the so-called whiskey put up in the United States was imitation whiskey. Chief Chemist Wiley, whose concern was not with the quantity, but with the quality, gave it as his information that over half the whiskey in this country was compounded whiskey. Less than half was genuine, and while they usually mix a little old whiskey with it, they often sell it purely and simply as it is, whiskey, which has no claim to be called whiskey under the real meaning of that term. But all that was only a beginning. The time came when the vision of a great liquor combination rose in certain minds in this country. It was planned to sweep the good brands and the bad brands alike into one common management, whose control the reader by this time suspect, and thus not only capitalize the reputation which the old-time American distillers had made through years of honest distilling, but use the trade names of pure goods as a mask for a deluge of the dishonest kind of liquor, which left a trail of suicide, insanity, crime, and social wreckage in its path. This, with independent testimony as to the Jewish direction of it all, will form the subject matter of a separate story. Dearborn Independent of the 17th of December, 1921.
All right, so I guess next week they're going to tell us, give details about this trail of suicide, insanity, crime, and social wreckage because of this crummy whiskey that they sell to people that has a bad effect.
Rot gut whiskey.
Yeah, you get drunk and you get addicted and so on, and it doesn't have the mellowing effect that it's used to have or is supposed to have, could have. Well, that's very interesting. I guess, you know, since they're going to do that, I haven't read that one yet, so I haven't read ahead. So, but I was going to say, well, you know, it's what they seem to be saying is that what they've done is bad enough, the business end of it, but that they've done all this damage to human beings, most of whom are not Jews, because we know Jews aren't usually big drinkers, but a lot of white people are. We know drinking is pretty, it has a bad effect on the Irish. Let's see, what's those other groups that, you know, Europeans that...
Well, supposedly it's a big problem in Russia, alcoholism.
Yeah, the Russians, that's right. They really have a problem with it. And they said somewhere about, or maybe I read that in something I was looking up about the vodka. They were making this vodka in Russia. Was that in this article? Somewhere I was reading that.
It said that the Jews ran the vodka trade in Russia.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, this business in Peoria, I lived in Peoria for a couple of years and lived close to it for a long time also. And I know that when you drive into Peoria, you could smell, you had that smell. It was the hops, you know, that's what it's called, said to be the hops. And it didn't smell bad. It smelled real different. But once you were there, you got used to it and didn't smell it anymore. But you sure could smell it. Drove in. Of course, when you drove in, the way I drove in, it was over a bridge, in, you know, over a river, and maybe that, I think that distillery was right close there. And I found a photograph. I was looking for, you know, images for this show. It wasn't easy to find anything. Best thing I found was this thing I'm going to use, which is kind of a cartoony advertisement of Clark, what's it called? Clark Whiskey. It doesn't say that it's the Great Western Distillery in Peoria, but it's from Peoria, and it's got to be, it's just one of the brands that they, you know, put on their whiskey, because it says this in the 1880s, the Great Western Distillery in Peoria was the largest in the world, and that later, in 1887, he organized, who was the president of it? This Austrian Jew, Joseph Greenhut. See, there's never heard about him in this article, but he was the head of this largest distillery in the world in the 1880s. He had come to the United States from Austria at age 9, you know, with his parents, to Chicago, and then he eventually he was born in 1843, so by the 1880s he was going great guns, and in 1887 he organized the Distillers and Cattle Feeders Company, became its first president of that, and it's said to have been modeled on Rockefeller's Standard Oil, and was generally referred to as the Whiskey Trust. So, you know, there was a lot of awareness of what was going on, but, and this was before Prohibition. But you know, they got away with all this stuff. He headed this trust until, more than 80 distilleries joined the trust that he started. And, he headed it until 1895, and then it was reorganized as the American Spirits Manufacturing Company. You know, they're always hidden behind there. Nobody knew. Whoever knew that Jews were so much into the liquor business? Well, we know they're in every kind of vice, so I guess.
Well, the Bronfmans, you know,
that's right.
They have Seagrams and all that, and they're heads of the World Jewish Congress.
Yeah, and then, you know, the Father Kennedy, Joseph P. Kennedy, he was doing well in a business that was dominated by Jews. You know, an Irishman who really didn't like Jews, but he was in that business and prospering too, in the liquor business. Mostly it's Jews. So what do you want to say about it?
Anything? Well, I was thinking about this use of the word conspiracy. It seems to be kind of questionable, actually, because, I mean, it's more just Jews being Jews and pursuing profits and being ethnocentric, and not so much that they said, you know, we're going to come in and poison the goyim and buy up the whole liquor industry.
But, you know, I hate to interrupt you, but, you know, there's too much of this these days. A lot of people are talking like this, like they want to get away from because I think this conspiracy theory advertising against this is having a good effect, you know, and so everybody's afraid of talking
about
conspiracy.
But the thing is, you don't have to explain it.
It doesn't take that much to have a conspiracy.
You don't have to explain it as a conspiracy.
Well, a conspiracy is when people make decisions together in business, which they don't is not open to others to know.
You know, it doesn't change the deleterious impact of what they did. But, you know, if you say that they consciously set out to take over the liquor industry and
but
make sure there
were
no... But
is the word conspiracy saying that? I think the way it's used here, I don't think meaning
so.
That much. Well, let me just say real quick that I think that this article shows that... We can't do the same as the Jews do. You know, they have this huge advantage because they're not afraid of going into business ventures that would make a Gentile think twice or hesitate.
Yeah. Well, you see, they
the
benefited.
Says, that's too big of a risk. But for these
Jews, benefited from their unscrupulousness and the fact that there wasn't adequate regulation.
Well, you can't have adequate regulation for these people. They
yes,
get around everything. They buy you off. Well, this is something we should do a whole program on this and talk this out. So we have to stop.
As they
for
say,
now,
a
though.
Bad money drives out good. Same
yeah.
With
we'll see you next week for the rest of this liquor business. Conspiracy.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.